This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
Welcome to a Joycast from Joy 94.9. Visit joy.org.au to find out more about our Joycasts.
Joy 94.9 Inside the Sound Museum tonight, your inside guide to the music industry. Now, Brian, our next guest has had 12 top 10 singles on the US Club Dance Chart, including 7 number one singles, 4 studio albums, and 16 singles.
Now, that's a decent catalogue right
exactly.
there.
Exactly. She's coming down under for the first time in like 15 years.
Unbelievable.
Later on this year, part of 90s Mania. Hello, Amber.
Hi, Amber.
Hi, Leo. Hi, Brian. How are you guys doing? Yes, I'm currently in Germany.
So you're in Germany, Amber. Would that be a Guten Morgen or a Guten Abend or a Guten Nacht for you?
Today, because it's in the afternoon right now, it's pretty much, you know, Guten Tag.
Guten Tag.
Means good day.
I learned a bit of German at school.
Amber, you grew up in the Netherlands, but you were partially raised in Germany. What was your childhood like? Because your mother was a songwriter and a piano teacher, and your father was an opera singer. So
wow.
I can see where you got your musical genes from.
Yeah, well, I was born in the Netherlands, and I lived there for about 6 years. My father was a professional opera singer, and my mother was a piano teacher and also did some songwriting on the side. So obviously I came from a pretty musically creative home, yeah. And my father then got hired in his profession in Germany, and that is when we moved to Germany. And that's where I spent the rest of my childhood and went to school and got my education. Later on, I moved back to the Netherlands for a couple of years. And after that, I lived 10 years in the United States. And currently, I'm back on German ground again.
My gosh, you've been busy, busy, busy.
That's incredible. I'd love to see how much frequent flyer points you have.
Well, yeah.
Now, Amber, let's go back a bit. When you first started doing, like, getting into singing and getting into music, what was your early musical inspirations? What was influencing you as far as singer-songwriters go?
Well, I'm sure that, you know, I mean, I grew up with music a lot. Obviously, also opera and classical music, which was not quite my thing. But then again, it also has to do with being quite temperamental in your youth years and going exactly the opposite way of what your father might maybe do, you know, the typical puberty thing. So I would have access to our attic where there were old vinyl singles from my parents, like Stevie Wonder, all the Motown stuff, Michael Jackson, Jackson 5, the Beatles, all that stuff. And I started listening to them on my little pickup. I was just, it just took me. It just, it really, really, really impressed me that it was not such a way of strict singing where, you know, you had to go note by note, but it really, you really felt that it was in the moment. And I felt very attracted to that. And I guess as a little schoolgirl, I remember in front of everybody and just told to sing. And looking back, I figured, well, you know, I must have been able already at a young age to be able to hold a note. Otherwise, the teachers would have said, oh, no, not her, please. please. No. You know, that's how it just went on. I started doing little, you know, little fashion shows where I would cover songs from Whitney Houston or Barbara Streisand, you know, whoever was big at that moment.
What about Nina? Nina, 99 Luftballons. Did you cover that one at all?
Oh, Nina, no, I was not so much into that at that time. I was really into more soul and R&B and gospel, and I did like musical quite a bit in terms of, like, I loved Barbara Streisand always. Her voice always touched me. Mm. And from there, it just progressed, you know? You hold a job down and you do a little music on the side. You do a little gig here, a little gig there, and then you happen to run into producers that heard you somewhere and said, well, are you interested in, you know, getting together? So, you know, I guess it's just the way pretty much everybody who has a music and career just starts. It's just people coming together at the right time, at the right moment, and have the right idea. Then I just got a deal offered in the United States while I was living in the Netherlands at that time still. It took me by surprise, quite honestly, at first, you know, because it's just a really such a big, huge thing and such a big, huge moment. And then my first record came out, This Is Your Night, which went gold in Australia, I believe, and, you know, all over the world. It was a pretty big record. And I remember in America, it stayed in this charts for about almost a year. And it's pretty much a blur, because everything happens so fast, you know. You just get sent to the left, to the right, and do an interview here and photo shoot there. So quite honestly, the first couple of years, it's just really a blur, because it was just so much traveling and so much back and forth. Yeah, that's when it took off.
When you were writing that track, did you realize this was something special, or did you know at the time this was going to be the one song that would break your career?
No, not really, because I, you know, I had done classical rock. I had done all kinds of genres, which were, you know, not as simple as, and not being negative here, but it was way more complicated musically, also lyrically way more complicated. So This Is Your Night really just derived from a moment of, okay, how about if we do a dance track? Oh, yeah, cool, why not? Well, we thought it was something along the line about, this is your night, da-da-da-da-da-da-da. You know, go ahead in the room and just write something. And I wrote the entire lyric and the entire melody line, and then I came up with da-ba-da-ba-da-da-da-da-day. It just transpired very, very quickly. So I felt like, okay, this is just another cute diddle, whatever. I would have never expected that that was the one that actually caught people's attention. But it was, at that point of time, it was the right style for the right time at the right moment. And the producers that I had worked with back then had already a successful track, I believe, with Real McCoy. So they already have connections to America.
Wow, yeah.
Real McCoy was back then signed with Arista. So Arista wanted to have it, but because Arista already had their first group, they felt that they wanted to have another record company to be their competition. So I ended up in the end with Tommy Boy Records. And, yeah, I would have never really, you know, I wouldn't think that far, quite honestly, because, you know, I was very much in the moment and enjoying, you know, the creative process. Looking back, obviously, you know, I had quite different styles of music going on, which were, you know, of different quality. That just hit, and I just took it from there.
I can still remember to this day, Amber, This Is Your Night, coming out from 1996. That was our theme track for our graduation when we passed and finished high school. And that was a bit of an anthem, our party anthem that we danced the night away to when we finished school. That's why I love that track so much.
It's always nice because you hear it quite a bit. You know, it's the story of my life, kind of. You know, you're the soundtrack to people's lives, obviously. People have such a connection to certain songs, and it's, you know, now I've just celebrated my 20th anniversary in this industry. You know, I hear all these different stories from people, also when I travel, when I tour. You know, I always take my time with meet and greets afterwards, and it's always very endearing, enchanting, and just very positive to hear that people have such nice memories to it, and they are so connected to these titles. It's just really a gift.
This is the night, dancing free until the morning light, together forever, cause this is your night.
Joy 94.9 Sound Museum, your inside guide to the music industry. That was Amber, This Is Your Night, a huge hit here in Australia, number 11 in Australia, going gold.
Massive.
Now, Amber, around that time you released your debut album, This Is Your Night, you actually came down to Australia. Is that right? Do you remember much of that first trip to Australia?
I do. I believe I've been in total, I've been in Australia, I believe, three times.
Okay.
I believe three times. But those tours were so tightly set up that I really could not really enjoy the surroundings. That also reflects all the other cities and all the other countries I've visited, because you were in and out, you know, next on to the next gig, on to the next gig, with hardly any sleep from one flight to another. What stood with me, though, is when I got off the plane, I kissed the floor because it was like a 24-hour ride of hell. and I was just happy to have ground under my feet again. But I felt instantly very comfortable. It was a very liberal European kind of atmosphere. Because, you know, sometimes you land in countries or cities where you're like, okay, I better look over my shoulder because something ain't just really quite right here. Mm. In Australia, I never had that. I felt very comfortable, very integrated right away. The people were very friendly. I remember being at Bondi Beach having the best scrambled salmon eggs of my life and banana bread. Indian food was really, really ridiculously good, too. It was just a really beautiful surrounding from what I saw while I was, you know, riding from one place to another. Although I must say, I remember having a driver that was actually drinking and driving.
Wow.
To the point where my road manager really had to sit him down and straighten him out.
Yes.
I remember that.
Now, us Aussies are very relaxed people, if you haven't already figured that one out, Amber.
Well, I survived, obviously. But at this point in time, I remember my road manager was really freaking out, and she really had to put him in the corner and say, listen, dude, you are driving some weight here with you, and we cannot afford to take a chance here that you might be, you know, taking one too many and have us not come back to the United States. So, but overall, I just have positive impressions. The people were very nice and very friendly, and one thing I look back and think to myself, I would have loved to visit New Zealand once because it was already so close. But at that point in time, I had a little boy. You know, I'm a mom also, and back then he was quite small still. So for me, it was always very important to get back home as soon as possible so I would not take time off for myself. This time, however, I might even bring my son with me. You know, he always said, Mom, if you ever go back to Australia, you know, let me know because I might, you know, jump on the plane with you.
Why not?
Yeah. I said, okay.
In the late 90s, you had some monster hits. Number 3 in Australia with If You Could Read My Mind with Ultranate and Jocelyn Isquez.
Unbelievable.
From the Studio 54 soundtrack. That track, we still play here on Joy.
Yeah.
And I still hear it in clubs all over the place. Still hear it.
Well and truly, one of the soundtracks of my life, that's for sure.
Yeah, it's a really major soundtrack. That actually went platinum in Australia. I'm looking here in my office, and I'm looking right at the platinum record from Australia here. That was a record that came about, that was a collaboration. So they called it Stars on 54 for some reason, but it belonged to the movie 54 with Mike Myers. It was a movie called Studio 54 about the old days of the Studio 54 club in New York. And I remember our vice president of a record company coming to me and say, listen, you know, we have Miramax Motion Picture asked us, you know, if we feel interested in doing a soundtrack. And I have this great idea about this track, If You Could Read My Mind, to redo it, to do a cover of it. And we thought maybe Ultranate and Jocelyn Enriquez and you could do the track together. Which back then, you know, collaborations were not easy to have at that point in time because every record company had their own little, you know, ego going on and blah, blah. But they made it happen. So we ended up in the studio and recorded the song. And when Miramax Motion Picture actually received the track, they had already wrapped up the movie pretty damn close. And they heard the soundtrack and they said, well, we need to wrap it open and we need to put these girls in the end scene. So they wrapped open the entire set again, and so that's how we ended up in the actual movie toward the end phase. We performed it a couple of times together. After that, everybody went along their way. As far as I'm informed, Jocelyn today is not even in the industry anymore. She became a mom, and I believe she became a teacher or something. Her career just stagnated at some point, and she got out and got married and stuff. Ultranate is very much still active. Actually, it was last year, when I'm not mistaken, I performed a song with her, and I did once and one other time years before that. So whenever venues happen to book us together and we're on the same bill, you know, we end up doing the song together. And for the rest, I keep performing it by myself, or Ultra does on her time. So. Yeah, but it's really a very successful song, and I even hear it in Europe, and, you know, it's a regular standard everywhere. and it's just a blessing.
Never thought I'd feel this way.
That was a huge hit from 1998. You Could Read My Mind.
Another dance floor anthem from Amber.
Love that one. She is on the line from Germany tonight. Now, Amber, one of my favourite songs is Sexual, which is a great song from your second self-titled
that
Amber.
That is hot. What a hot track that one is.
That video, we all remember that video because it was... The
it
hunky
was
guy.
It was steaming hot.
It was the hunky guy and the little dog.
I know. And that guy, I'm telling you, his name was Raphael. And I remember with my second album, I took more charge of my career because I didn't feel comfortable really with my old producer team. They were too simple-minded in my world. And also lyrically, you know, it was all too simple for me. I wanted to have a little bit more... I wanted to put my stamp on it. So I had decided to write with outside writers, have more creative control. That particular song, Sexual Lita D, came about in a time where it was okay for guys to, you know, to come out and sing about booties and stuff like that. But for girls to talk about sexuality was always a moment of, oh, no, you can't do that. We can't play that on radio. That's too dirty. Which sexual is really just, you know, nothing dirty or, you know, it was just, from my perspective, playful sexuality, feelings that we all have, you know, however, you know, whatever turns you on, but really a nicely set up song. I wrote this with Billy Steinberg and Rick Knowles in the Hollywood Hills, and it was written, believe it or not, in 15 minutes. That was a song where I immediately knew the minute he pressed this little recorder and replayed it, I said, that's it. That's going to be huge. I just know, because it was instantly, it just stuck with you.
Yeah.
And then I went back with my road manager in the car, and I played it for her, and she was just screaming in the back. And my record label obviously felt it right away, too, thank God, because sometimes you can run into issues, obviously, there, too, because there's a huge team that makes decisions. And I remembered having to shoot the video, and I had a very clear vision. I said, well, first of all, I'm not the kind of girl that's going to run around naked with her booty cheeks hanging out.
Thank goodness for that.
Factually, look at the video. I'm always dressed. You will just see me taking off my shoe, or it's a sheet completely wrapped around my body. You will just see the shoulders free, but there's nothing else showing, really.
Very seductive.
Yeah.
And I remember... Having to actually pick out the right guy so you would have some chemistry. Oh, my God. And there were just tons of guys lining up, you know, to come in and play that part. And then this guy, Rafael, came from Cuba, and my knees just got weak. I was like, okay, this is the one. It was a really, really, really fun experience. I mean, the dog was... That was something my A&R back then wanted to do, felt the need to do. I thought it was a little crazy to have a talking freaking chihuahua in there. Her name was, by the way. And she would only eat filet mignon.
Oh,
but, oh well, you know, it's a hang-up. I digress. It's a hang-up somehow, but it didn't have to be in there for me personally. But, oh well, it happened.
much steamy sexual tension in that song. I adore that.
Now, Amber, let's fast forward to 2002, your third album, Naked. Some big hits from that one. Yes, The Need to Be Naked. After the album was released, you parted ways with Tommy Boy Records. What was going on behind the scenes at that time? And I guess you obviously were in more control of your career, correct?
Yeah. Never forget, first of all, I wanted to say, you know, every person I meet in my life or met in my life and have worked with in my life, you know, they obviously all had a role and it all had a purpose. And I will never forget that also those, even if the parts were sometimes complicated or maybe, you know, not so positive as I wished for, I grew and learned from that. At that time, I really felt that my record company was not giving their all, was not giving their best to promote me, because here I was with 7 number one hits consecutively in the charts, and yet I felt that there was not enough visibility, and when I felt there needed to be a video, you know, they would not shoot enough videos. I felt they would not really invest in me enough, because back then when I got signed on, I figured, you know, it was just that dance, Eurodance wave, and they all felt, okay, we're going to get one or two maybe out of her, and then we dump her and we get the next. I think they didn't count with the success that was coming along or that people would really stick with me.
Mm.
On top of that, I was constantly somehow directly or indirectly told that I was not good enough. I needed to lose weight. I need to put more makeup on. I need to put these kind of clothes on. And they were totally not seeing the connection that I had with my actual fans, because it's beautiful to have a 100% choreographed show and everything just walks perfectly and fireworks and blah, blah, blah. But it's what they don't understand is, or what I felt they didn't understand is, it is way more important to connect to your fans and to have an interaction with the crowd, and that people somehow also can connect and relate to you. I mean, you look at Adele, for instance, right now. You know, she's not the perfectly zero size girl, but why does it work? Because she has a way with people. She's natural. She, you know, she does herself. And I was being restricted more and more in toward interviews, what I'm allowed to say, what I'm not allowed to say. There were double standards in what rappers could do or what dance artists could do. And I'm not that kind of girl to be restricted, to be honest, Leo and Brian. It's just not my thing to be restricted. So on top of that, we came in that time where the music industry was really failing. You know, they just neglected the whole illegal downloading thing. You know, the sales were not up to par. And did they just had money in their pipelines, you know, while using and abusing and not paying out their artists. They just didn't care. They didn't take care of us. So at that point of time, I made a decision and said to the, because I already had gotten, bought myself out of my first producer contract and gotten a new contract with Tommy Boy directly with my company. And then I went up to my record company's boss and told him, look, I'm not happy with how things are going here. I really feel you guys are somehow not doing the job. You know, I'm in there and paying extra money to get people to promote my stuff. You know, it shouldn't be that way. You know, I can do that by myself. So one thing that I've done throughout those years is always silently look over people's shoulders, how they've done their work. So I silently learned for myself what is important. So I asked for release back then after the Naked album. And thankfully, they granted me that, because a lot of artists get shelved for years and cannot do anything.
Yeah.
So I'm very thankful that he let me go. Then I hired a small team for myself, in which they also taught me quite a bit. But at that point of time, I really felt good. If it fails, it's my, you know, my wrongdoing. If it goes well, it's my well-doing. And I was able to put all the responsibility on myself. It just felt better toward me. And I didn't want to be that tool anymore that was exhausted and just exacerbated and taken out to the full max. Now I can have an easy life, because my priority is not to be a billionaire. It's just not. I want to have an enjoyable life where I can do what I like. I can act the way I really truly am. I can take time with my son. I can take time with my friends, and I can just live a livable life. Whereas when you have that extreme success and extreme pressure it just wasn't me. It's just not meant for me. And let's be honest, you look around you, you know, these people that are incredibly successful, you know, you see a lot of sad stories on the side road of them, you know, what happens, because there's always some neglect that comes with it. And I wasn't doing, I was not sacrificing that for fame. It's just not my thing.
Yeah, and you mentioned before that the industry was changing at the time because there's all the downloading and everything. It was completely changing it on its head. And I think the labels had no idea what to do. And I think you got it at the right time.
I don't think it's not. No. I don't think it was. I disagree with you here. I don't think they didn't know what to do. They were not thinking collectively. Everybody was just thinking about themselves. They were not really caring about the collective. And until today, it's very much not about that, because recordings are ingrained with ISRC codes and with the sale codes. You know, everything that is officially released, they would take use of those codings, you know, and they would actually build up a platform where when people try to share illegally those songs, those encodings would right away blink up. I believe that there is a possibility. For God's sake, Leo, people can fly to the moon.
Exactly.
You know, for me, it is not impossible to do. It is just somebody needs to start, you know, put money into it and collectively come together and really see the industry as a collective, as a whole, and then get to work. But somehow, you know, people are just okay, obviously, where they are.
Exactly.
So, unfortunately, you know, not too much has happened since then.
Fourth album was independent, My Kind of World, in 2004.
Yeah.
And doing it independently, doing it from scratch, recording it, obviously doing the songwriting and promoting it and everything, it must have been quite liberating at the time.
How good did it feel, Amber, having that that freedom?
Oh, absolutely. It felt ridiculously good, you know. There was nobody in my neck telling me what to do, what to sing, what I can write about or what not, or what style of music, because I am not stuck in one genre. That's another thing that I, you know, felt. America was very categorized at that time already, you know. Either you're this or you're that. There was no openness toward a mixed musical experience of different styles, of fusion. And that album, obviously, in its originality, has nothing to do with dance music. It was just really, at that point of time, what I went through about my liberation. At that point of time, I also was almost at the end of my divorce from my husband. So there's a lot of, you know, a lot of emotions poured into that. And it obviously didn't take on as well as the other ones, which I was not surprised about, because I know that a lot of fans, you know, expect you to continue to do the same thing. But for me, that was not important. For me, it was important that I was not being put in that little box anymore, so they could see what I was capable of musically and do other things. So for me, personally, in my growth as an artist and in my growth as a person, it still means a lot to me to this day. You know, it was one of my, obviously, you know, pieces that fell very close to my heart.
Playlist at the moment, Amber, is your collaboration with the lovely Zelma Davis on the cover of the classic Barbra Streisand and Donna Summer classic, No More Tears, Enough is Enough. Now, being a fan of Barbra Streisand, and of course the late Donna Summer, what a legend she is. But covering that track with Zelma, big shoes to fill. And do you know if Barbara has heard the track? Has she touched base with you about the track, or any feedback from Barbara about the track?
I think I would die if she would say something.
I'm sure she's heard it.
Happily ever after. No. The thing is, I actually, a couple of years before I covered that song, it was always a song that I loved. Now, I've always been a big fan of Barbara Streisand, and I remember I was in Milwaukee somewhere doing a show, and before me, they had this little, tiny, gorgeous girl on stage, and I heard her sing, and I said, my God, where the hell does this voice come from? She is so tiny, so little, until I realized she was the singer of back then the group CNC Music Factory. Mm. So we met backstage, and I said to Zelma, I said, girl, I said, that voice of yours, incredible. I said, you know, I would really like to collaborate with you one day. And she was like, right. She was the sweetest to today. She's the sweetest thing. So she said, oh, I would love that. I said, okay. I said, look, I have my own label. I said, let's talk about those, you know, in a later time when we have more time to think about that. She was like, okay. Now, I happened to find out as I continued staying in touch with her that she was a huge fan of Donna Summer. That was her childhood hero, and she loved Donna Summer. I said, so obviously this is meant to be. You're a huge Donna Summer fan. I'm a huge Barbara Streisand fan. I mean, I love Donna Summer too, don't misunderstand. Incredible voice. But Barbara Streisand was it for me, just like for her it was Donna Summer. And it's a song that I always loved, and I said to her, I said, what do you think about it? She was like, oh, fantastic. Why not? So we got together in the studio, and I said to her, I said, look, if it doesn't turn out the way I feel it should turn out, you know, because we are really, I mean, we were very aware that we are filling some really, you know, huge shoes here. And, you know, kind of like, okay, can we really do this? I said, then it's not coming out. I said, you know, either it's going to work out and it's going to sound great and we can do it, or it's just going to be shelved. She was like, okay. So we went into the studio and we had a lot of fun. And I think it turned out great for a cover version, because sometimes you have cover versions where you're like, nah, you shouldn't have done that. But we felt confident enough at that point of time that it was strong enough and that it was very well interpreted and gave our little own snitch to it. So, yeah, that was 2009.
Marks 20 years as a recording artist. Your gay fan base has always been there with you. You've got such a huge gay
fan base. We're very loyal. Very loyal to you, Amber.
Very, very.
Yeah, and you've done gay pride gigs in the US and everything. And
everywhere.
Everywhere, pretty much, right? And for the first time in a long time, you're finally coming back down to Australia for 90s Mania this September. Now, on the bill, aside from your fine South girlfriend, you've got Hathaway, you've got LaBouche, you've got Jenny from Ace of Base, and Katrine from Black Box. Now, have you met any of those artists? It must be a big lot of fun on the road.
Yes, actually, I toured with LaBouche in '97 pretty extensively over an entire summer. But that's when Melanie, the lead singer, was still alive.
Yeah,
y'all probably are familiar with what happened to her.
Yeah,
unfortunately, when she went solo in her career, you know, she had a tragic accident where the plane came down, and
that's tragic, very sad.
So I know that the rapper, I know that he got a new girl. Singing that part. I mean, what else is his option, you know, at that time? Mm. I haven't heard them, you know, I don't know how they're doing together, how they are smoothing together. I remember, however, being on tour with Melanie for quite a while. As for the others, Hathaway, obviously, we know what is love, you know. I know his music, kind of, but I have never been on tour with him. Ace for Base was obviously huge, too, in the 90s. Oh, that she won, you know, all these songs. But I have not been in contact in any kind of way with the others. The only one I've been on tour with extensively is La Bouche.
Yeah. All over Australia. It's a really big tour. And you're going to be in Melbourne at the Track and Toorak, which is a great venue, Friday the 2nd of September. And have you ever been to Melbourne before?
Oh, yeah. I've been to Melbourne. I've been to Sydney, Adelaide. Yeah. You know, the whole coast thing, I've done that up and down. Yes, absolutely.
Yeah.
But like I said, it's been a while.
I know. And
I want a wombat.
Exactly. We'll get you one.
Yeah.
Now, Dole, we have to say, what's on your playlist? This is my wish list, all right? I wish for, please. Obviously, this is your night. Maybe one more night. If you could read my mind, definitely sexual, love one another, and maybe a bit of yes, I need to be naked.
Mm-hmm.
And even the collaboration with Zelma, that'd be amazing.
You can make that times two, because I think I'd love to hear all of them as well.
They're all in it. And you have, let me see, you got pretty much a lot of them already, but they're all being touched. That's correct.
Yay!
yep, and then we have, I believe, Just Like That, and I Don't Believe in Hate.
So how long did you sit for? Half an hour? More than that, 45 minutes?
Yeah, we do, you know, I guess everybody's doing about half an hour. Well, I'm smart about that, because I had to get smart about that, because, you know, when you do these venues, when you have lineups or you do club venues, they don't want you to stay on stage for 3 hours. They just don't want you to do that.
Mm.
So what I've came up with already years ago, when you have seven number ones, you know you're not going to have enough time to sing them full out. So I started producing them in medleys. Where you have, you know,
yes,
leads.
Very clever.
Because I remember, you know, I remember at one point I started to just say, you know what, this is your night. Okay, it's the first song. Let's cut it out. Honey, I did that two shows. People wanted to beat me up. It was that serious. So I understood very early on, okay, you need to at least, you know, have people, give people what they want, you know, because that's what they come for, because they have some form of relation, some story to tell with that song. And it's just a great position to be in. It's just a really wonderful position to be in. So, you know, I'm going to do them all, honey.
What else can we expect, Amber, from your performance on the night? I'm not sure what's going to happen with the other artists. Can we expect, like, any, you know, hot male dancers or a backing band? Can you tease us with what we could expect?
I used to have up to six dancers with me. It's just a lot of luggage that you have to carry with you. I'm not sure yet how they are building up their stages and what else they have planned. They might do it. You know, they just felt, okay, the artists need to come. We need to fly in the artists. What they, in the end, also add to it, I'm not really in the loop on that matter quite yet. But the bottom line is, I'm going to be on stage. I'm going to sing the hell out of myself.
Keep us guessing.
We can't wait.
And like I said, Leo, I want a wombat.
Yes, but I will try and get you one. It might be a fake one.
We've got plenty of kangaroos. We can give you a kangaroo if you like.
No, Amber is, and you can get Amber's tracks all over iTunes and your favourite online store. There's heaps of them on there, all the hits, all the singles, the albums all on there. You can catch Amber live around Australia this September with Hathaway, La Bouche, Jenny from Ace of Base and Katrin from Black Box. Tickets available right now nationally through Ticketmaster or Ticketek.
That is a stellar lineup. What a great show that's going to be.
You can follow Amber on Facebook, Artist Amber, Twitter, Amber Sings, and on YouTube, her channel is Amber Foyer.
I like that.
Amber, thank you so much for joining us tonight on Joy.
Thanks, Amber.
Leo, Brian, thank you so much. It's been such a great time I had with you guys on the phone and talking a little behind off, and I so look forward to see you guys very, very, very soon.
Yes.
And bring me a wombat, will you?
Yes, we will bring you a wombat, and it's all good. Now, when you're in Melbourne, I know your schedule's really tight because you're flying, I think, the day before Melbourne, you're going to be in another state, and then Melbourne, then another state after that. But hopefully, you can come into Joy and see Australia's only LGBTI radio station.
Right. I would love to.
Yeah, yeah, of course. And we'll catch up and we'll do a coffee and whatever. It'd be great.
Okay, wonderful. You know what I want, right?
Yeah, of course.
She wants a wombat. Yes.
We got it for you, honey. We got it for you. Thank you so much.
This Joycast is a free service brought to you by Joy 94.9. Support Joy 94.9 by becoming a member at joy.org.au.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help us keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.